the GI Cancer Podcast, brought to you by the European Society of Digestive Oncology.
Welcome to our episode, Management of Advanced Cholangiocarcinoma. My name is Alisa Beutel. I'm a resident in gastroenterology at Ulm University Hospital in Germany. Today, we are privileged to have a leading expert from the field, Thomas Seuferlein, as our guest. Professor Seuferlein is the head of the Department of Internal Medicine 1 at Ulm University Hospital. We are fortunate to have such a renowned expert with us today. Welcome, Professor Seuferlein, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Today, we'll be discussing the management of cholangiocarcinoma, a rare and aggressive cancer of the bile duct. So biliary tract cancers are typically classified based on their anatomical location within the biliary tree. Could you start by giving us an overview of the different subtypes and explain why this classification is clinically relevant?
Well, we learned over the recent years that it's indeed relevant to differentiate cholangiocarcinoma between the intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas, the extrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas, and the gallbladder cancers, because they not only differ with respect to anatomy, but they also differ with respect to their molecular setup and even their precursor lesions. And therefore, we really have to observe this very simple split between intra, extrahepatic, and gallbladder cancer.
Okay, thank you. So surgery is typically the only curative option for biliary tract cancers, but unfortunately most patients present with advanced or metastatic disease. So what is the standard of care treatment in those patients?
So for systemic treatment in advanced cholangiocarcinoma, the first line treatment is gemcitabine plus cisplatinum, and we can add, this has been shown by several trials, either durvalumab or pembrolizumab, so immune checkpoint inhibitors interfering with the PD-1, PD-L1 pathway.
So do you see any difference between the regimens or between the immune checkpoint inhibitors, or would you consider them comparable?
Well, theoretically there might be differences. In practice, we see very similar results with hazard ratios for durvalumab of 0.8, for pembrolizumab of 0.83. Median overall survival is fairly similar, a bit more than 12 months in each case. So clinically, it doesn't seem to pan out too much. It seems to be fairly well comparable.
Okay. So nearly 40% of patients with biliary tract cancer have genetic alterations that may be targeted by specific therapies. So can you tell us a little bit about when and how you initiate molecular testing?
I would recommend molecular testing rather early in the disease process. Well, so usually we would like to do that when we initiate first-line treatment to be prepared upon advancement of disease. And usually what we would do is check for mutations in IDH1, IDH2, and we would also check for HER2 alterations, amplifications in particular, and FGF2 receptor fusions, rearrangements, but also mutations, bearing in mind that the majority of drugs we have available so far doesn't target the mutations, but there is a new generation coming up that will do that as well. But it's always good to have things at hand once there is progress of disease and to really see what options the patient might have. And what we also learned is that these alterations are not due to tumor evolution. So this is not, there is not a lot of change during chemotherapy in first line. So we can establish that straight away and we will see whether or not the alteration is there, either when we check first very early on or we check later. So my recommendation would be to check as early as possible. Given that there is a reimbursement for testing, I clearly see that this is still an impediment of doing the testing early.
So now you told us a lot of about clinically relevant alterations. Can you tell us a little bit of the targeted therapies that are approved in cholangiocarcinoma?
Yeah, we have, for example, for the IDH1, IDH2 alterations, we have ivosidenib as a targeting agent, and for the FGF R2 fusions and rearrangements, we have pemigatinib approved. And there are novel drugs now coming up, like futibatinib, which is expected to be approved in due course. And we have other agents targeting not only FGFR2 rearrangements and fusions, but also mutations, like, for example, tilengotinib, which is at the moment in clinical trials. And there are other components such as Relay, who are highly efficient and have the advantage of being very specifically targeting FGFR2 and thereby avoiding side effects by cross-reaction with FGFR1 or FGFR4.
So what is your experience with those targeted agents? So I understood that you have a patient who received a prolonged treatment with an FGFR2 inhibitor. So could you share a little bit?
Yeah, we have in patients with FGFR rearrangements and fusions. This is quite interesting. We had indeed several patients that progressed on chemotherapy, and this was still the age where we didn't have any approved drugs for second line, so we actually treated them first line with combination chemotherapy. They received second line chemotherapy, and then at that stage we had a compassionate use program where we could use an FGFR2 inhibitor, and this was pemigatinib, and we had a tremendous response. This was a patient with advanced disease, bone metastasis, liver metastasis, lymph node metastasis, in particular also lung metastasis, and we had a massive reduction in the tumor load in this patient, more than 80%, and there were very small residing lesions, and this was lasting over almost 2 years. Then the patient progressed. But the side effects during this FGFR2 inhibition were, compared to what he had before and the combination chemotherapy, far less, and his quality of life was really excellent.
This is very impressive. So how do you decide which FGFR2 inhibitor to use? Is there a difference between the two that are available?
There is indeed. Well, first of all, it's simple to decide because we only have one targeting agent approved, which is pemigatinib, outside of clinical trials. And we were fortunate to have a compassionate use program running for futibatinib, and we could actually access this program. And we had patients now being progressing on pemigatinib and still benefiting from futibatinib, despite, and we thought there might have been a different mutation, or sometimes you get a mutation in the receptor when you have a rearrangement, but still the patient was progressing, had no difference in the setup, but futibatinib was far more efficient, and that was another 1.5 years of progression-free survival for the patient. And now the patient is progressing again, and we're wondering what to do. Now we're looking for other targets like BRAF mutations, which the patients didn't have in this case, and HER2 amplifications, which the patient also didn't have. So we're a bit at loss at the moment. But there's indeed a case for sequencing also FGFR inhibitors, because sometimes patients are progressing despite the target is the same. Mm-hmm. But still changing, altering the inhibitor makes sense. And sometimes there is actually an additional mutation or alteration in the FGFR2 that can be then targeted with another drug, another advanced drug that not only focuses on the fusions and rearrangements, but also addresses the mutations.
Okay, thank you. So if the patient progressed and there are no more molecular targeted agents, do you have a second line therapy, second line chemotherapy, or a later line that is approved?
Yeah, no, we don't have any approved treatment at that stage. And as I said, we're checking, of course, for BRAF alterations. A raw study showed that targeting V600E does make sense in these patients. HER2 alterations, then it would be interesting to use, for example, trastuzumab deruxtecan as a combination, but this is all, everything is off-label because we don't have any approval for any of these drugs. But usually, if we don't find anything at all, then we would try, for example, irinotecan or non-liposomal irinotecan in combination with 5-FU, according to the NIFTY trial that showed a benefit with respect to progression-free survival when employed in second line. I appreciate we have a German study that didn't show that effect, so we have a little bit of ambivalent data in this respect, but some patients do benefit from irinotecan. We ourselves ran a first-line trial with irinotecan, the KNIFE study, and showed that particular patients with extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma seemed to benefit from the addition of irinotecan to 5-FU in second line. So that's what we would try, 5-FU plus irinotecan in this setting.
Mm, okay.
But it's off-label.
And could you tell us a little bit about the prognosis? So how long do patients live with advanced or metastatic cholangiocarcinoma?
That's a that's a very important question, because that's a question patients always ask you. And to be honest, I always tell them I don't know how long an individual is going to live. Mm-hmm. Of course, we have statistics, and we already mentioned before the median overall survival in the trials with Gemcitabine or Gemcitabine was 12.5 months. Mm. So this is when we sequence treatment with, if there is an alteration, I have been treating patients over 4 years. I have a patient now who is 5 years under treatment with advanced cholangiocarcinoma. So this is possible, but we are in an era now where we really have to see how these novel agents work out and how the patients respond. Do they all respond the same? Are there differences also with respect to response to FGFR2 inhibition, for example, or IDH1-2? There might be differences between the different mutations impacting on prognosis, and we don't know that yet, because still a rare cancer, and it's still a small proportion of patients having the alteration. So we're learning, and I always tell my patients, we have to see while we go. We try to get as much as possible if quality of life is good. Overall, I would think between 20 months, 2 years is possible, but we have also seen patients dying within a year after diagnosis. And this is mainly due also to complications of disease, like bile duct obstruction, cholangiosepsis, and a lot of patients die due to complications due to obstruction of bile ducts in cholangiocarcinoma. Mm. Not so much because of disease progression itself, and also due to cholestasis. Mm. Because sometimes you have cholestasis in areas of the liver you cannot drain properly, and then you have bilirubin elevations and liver failure.
Mm. Okay, this is important to know. So with the advancements that we saw over the last years, how do you think the treatment landscape will be evolving in the next, let's say, 5 or 10 years?
I think we will definitely move these targeted agents into first line. I think we will treat fewer and fewer patients when they have targetable alterations with chemotherapy. So my assumption would be that we get all these drugs in first line, and we'll see that they might even work better. We might even do some neoadjuvant approaches where we then make patients resectable, because we do see, particularly in those with the FGFR2 alterations, quite interesting responses to these drugs. I mentioned that to you. So there might be a chance of having a downsizing effect, maybe even a downstaging, and subsequent option for local treatments, being it radiotherapy, SBRT, for example, or being it liver surgery. So there is a change definitely going on. Whether or not they can be combined with chemotherapy and then increase efficacy is also a matter of clinical trials that are running at the moment. And of course, I think we will see also more alterations coming up that are targetable. And we have another interesting area is going to be novel treatments that actually target different structures by specific antibodies, antibody drug conjugates, that also may be game changers in this context. So okay, there's a lot to come.
Yeah, okay. So before we wrap up, could you give our listeners a few key take-home messages on the management of advanced cholangiocarcinoma?
I think it is very important, first of all, to have proper biliary drainage to be able to avoid a cholangitis, and to be very observant when patients get a fever, do something and tell patients to come present themselves that you can intervene. The second is do check for all possible molecular alterations, because there are interesting options nowadays that can and should be used for the sake of the patients. And patients with cholangiocarcinoma are special because they have this risk of infections on the one hand, but also you can do a lot if you treat them right and do the best you can.
Okay, thank you, Professor Zöpferlein, for sharing your expertise with us today. It's been a great discussion, and I'm sure our listeners have gained a lot of insight into the management of advanced cholangiocarcinoma.
Alicia, it was a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to ASTO Podcast.